Welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. So let me provide an introduction to the JPC and our work. We are a 501c3 organization providing perspectives and analysis on foreign and domestic policies by leading scholars, academics, and commentators, and as today, the occasional military officer. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. In this series of calls, we've been trying to shift people's focus from the health aspects of the Wuhan virus pandemic to its impact on the internal and foreign policy choices of the countries that are America's friends and America's adversaries. Today, we're going to concentrate on Hezbollah and Lebanon with Brigadier General Asaf Orion, IDF Reserve. The general joined Israel's Institute for National Security Studies as a senior research fellow following 32 years of IDF service. He was a visiting military fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and later became an international fellow there. In his final post in the IDF, General Orion served as head of the Strategic Division in the Planning Directorate of the IDF General Staff, responsible for strategic planning, policy formation, international cooperation, military diplomacy, and liaison to neighboring militaries and peacekeeping forces in the region, which is where we get today's subject. He headed the IDF team to talks with UNIFIL and the Lebanese Armed Forces. He is also the director of the INSS research program on China, which I suspect we will get to as well. Before I turn over the microphone, let me remind the listeners that questions can be submitted during the presentation. Send your questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. General, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, good evening from Israel, and thank you for taking the time to be with us. I'll talk a little about the situation in Lebanon under, let's say, a title of how to prevent the next war with Hezbollah, understanding how devastating it will be. Not a walk in the park for Israel, even though the destruction on the Lebanese side will be unprecedented. So we'll start with the good news. Since 2006 and the Second Lebanon War, both Israel and Lebanon enjoy an unprecedented calm and quiet across their border. Both of them are uninterested in war and are mutually deterred. This mutual deterrence is a stabilizer, but it's based on the mutual assessment of destruction expected and the limited benefit. And also due to the fact that both parties, I think, believe that escalating to war is a real option. It's not some pie in the sky. We do see silver lining in the fact that Hezbollah is under deep duress because of the Iran sanction, because of the direct sanction upon it, because of rising criticism in the Lebanese public, exacerbated by COVID, but it started even before that with the economic meltdown and serious criticism against corruption. Recently, we also were happy to learn that Germany designated the Hezbollah on both its wings as a terror movement, and joining others, US, UK, the Netherlands, and others who already did it. What are the bad news so far? Since the end of the 2006 war, both parties are seriously preparing for a possibility of a next war. As one of my colleagues said yesterday, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. I'm not that, let's say, resolve that it's got to be, but it is a very probable option. The capability of both sides to inflict heavy damage has seriously increased. We're looking at an unprecedented level of war. Hezbollah in 2006 shot 4,000 rockets, most of them small warheads, into Israel in a month or so. Right now, the assumption is that we are going to see between 1,000 and 2,000 rockets of Hezbollah falling in Israel per day. That you can do the math of how much it grew. Israel on its side is planning by its military strategy to strike thousands of targets in Lebanon per day. This is like something like 100 times more if you count impact points and not just rocket launched. Hezbollah understand this problem between the quantity you launch and how many impacts you get. And hence it's seeking the precision project, trying to convert rockets who are imprecise to precise missiles, guided missiles. This is a serious threat to Israel, and our leadership already said it won't accept seeing this project go ahead in Lebanon. Another piece of bad news is that the post-war security regime, encapsulated in the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701, was seriously eroded. Hezbollah today in Lebanon is a dominant political actor. Its competition has been weakened after the Hariri assassination and something that looked like a coup in 2008. Its influence over the Lebanese armed forces has increased. The military capability, which is illicit because it's out of the government's control, has grown 10 times in rockets or more. It used to have 12,000 in 2006. Now it has something between 130 or 150,000 rockets with heavy warheads included. It has accumulated operational experience fighting in Syria, but it also suffered thousands of casualties there. We now see quite a massive and intensive military deployment along the blue line, which is the border more so between Israel and Lebanon. We saw it with the assault tunnel project. Israel, 2 years ago, more or less, exposed six assault tunnels crossing our border coming from Lebanon into Israel. And they were supposed to enable a surprise attack behind our defense line into Israel and to attack our settlements. So back in the end of 2018, the IDF destroyed all of them and this project was dead in the water. But we see them in observation, in reconnaissance, in special forces near the border, and occasionally it chooses to shoot anti-tank or IED. And last month, in mid-April, we saw them signaling to us, cutting three places in the security fence. I also want to note the ongoing harassment and impeding of freedom of access and movement to the UN force in Lebanon, named UNIFIL. And that's very indicative to where Hezbollah is there. UNIFIL is pretty much neutralized of seriously being active. And it's also somewhat being deterred from reporting the truth. Another worrying sign is that Hezbollah and Iran are busy establishing military capability in Syria and opening a new frontier for Israel there. And as the war in Syria is dying out, Hezbollah can again refocus on Israel, Nasrallah had a speech yesterday, and he was quite, I think, proud and confident, and had some serious threats and so on. I would say this powder keg in Lebanon has four fuses which can make it go off. One is that Israel or the U.S. might attack Iran's nuclear program, which is now advancing. If this will happen, most probably Hezbollah will need to repay all the Iranian investment and attack Israel in return. A second fuse leading to the keg is Hezbollah's precision project, which I described before, and Israel's resolve to stop it. At the end of August, there was a report on a drone attack on some industrial mixer in Beirut, and Hezbollah said that Israel did it, and in return, attacked Israel by an anti-tank cross-border missile. Fortunately, it ended with no casualties, so we called it a day and went to have a beer. At the same time, we need to look at what's happening in the Golan when Hezbollah is trying to dig in and Israel is trying to uproot it. When Hezbollah people die, they sometimes want to respond in Lebanon. And last is that, like the fourth fuse, is that something tactical may occur on the contact line, on the blue line, either by itself or because of the previous issues of Syria and so on. And then if casualties fall, it can escalate pretty quickly. So what I'm saying in this level is that war is not out of the cards, but in, and that beside preparing to war, which my IDF colleagues are doing fine, and beside suppressing the thoughts about its possible eruption and denying it, which most of the international community is doing, I think we should invest serious efforts in trying to prevent it. We need to acknowledge that wars start despite the party's interest to avoid them. There's a whole book about that. It's called March of Folly by Barbara Tuchman. And I grew to understand this is not a book. It's a binder. Everybody's invited to add their own folders. Over time, the risk for a war is growing, and it's a real possibility. We should acknowledge with the international community that the 2005-06 policy, which was designed after the Hariri assassination and after the war, needs review because reality has changed and the goals are getting further, not nearer. We need to acknowledge the 1701 tools have been eroded and that the Lebanese government and its army, or at least parts of it, are part of the problem and not just part of the solution. And on the bright side, we're seeing a Lebanese crisis, which makes Lebanon very needy for international aid. And that's the time to try to ratchet up an international effort to stop Iranian arms exports and Lebanese arms imports from Iran, because this is a non-governmental issue. We need to try to increase the pressure on Hezbollah as a terror and crime organization, and we need to go after its supporters, including those in the Lebanese government and in the Lebanese armed forces. We need to hold the Lebanese government accountable and demand that it implements its commitment. We need to stop just providing aid, which is based on wishful thinking, and we should condition the aid on reforms, on security arrangements, on verifiable measures, performance-based, We have some opportunities I think we can pursue on the gas prospects in the East Med. It can be tied to maritime delineation of EEZ, of economic exclusive zones. We can think creatively that if Israel succeeded in reaching some security arrangements with Hamas, which is definitely a bitter enemy, never to be considered as a peace partner, but we managed to hammer out some arrangement of economy against security, and we can try to implement that concept with Hezbollah as well, and trying to stabilize reality rather than admire it. And we can have some improvements on UNIFIL, which is quite critical in its liaison capability, in its interposition capability over the border, because communication is a very strong component of deconfliction and preventing escalation. There's a lot that can be done in trying to improve its access, its operability, its reporting. And if not, we believe that it's time to signal to Lebanon that this game can't go on. And unless they allow more access and authorities, the force should be cut down in size according to its authorities. So that's, I think, an opening exposition that can put us in track for Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a number of questions and a number of questions that I want to try to put together. One is about UNIFIL, and it's a two-part question. First of all, is UNIFIL hampering Israel's opportunities to create facts on the ground in Lebanon? And number two, since UNIFIL clearly has problems controlling Hezbollah, which is part of its mandate, why is it that Israel continues to go to the United Nations and ask for better UNIFIL, more UNIFIL, or whatever? Should Israel consider asking UNIFIL to leave? Those are the two questions.
We're looking at life as a choice between alternatives. In many cases, a choice between bad alternatives. So if we need to choose between no UNIFIL at all and the current situation, I think the choice is not optimal. We acknowledge the fact that UNIFIL is useful on liaison and interposition and keeping international attention and some reporting. By the way, when we sit with UNIFIL officers, you know, tete-a-tete, four eyes, or just between us girls, the national military is sending those people, are professional armies. They know what's going on. And as long as they are there, the professional reports go home. So each capital of the troop contributing countries is well aware of what's going on in Lebanon, at least on the military level. Then when you go to the diplomats and the politicians, there are different aspects there. And this is why what I call for is downsizing UNIFIL, also to decrease the risk to peacekeepers if war erupts, because we might find 10,000 troops in the worst blazing battlefield you can think of. At the same time, just kicking them out is not necessarily the first thing we want to do. So downsizing and leveraging the downsizing to bring some, let's say, pressure to Lebanon, to the UN system, is an okay thing. When we think of UNIFIL's mandate, UNIFIL's mandate was carefully hammered out that UNIFIL needs to support the Lebanese armed forces. But now we have a false chain of blind leading the blind, because the Lebanese armed forces are under the government, which is under Hezbollah in a way, or at least under the thumb. And so it's a chain of paralysis. We need to squeeze as much as we can from in legitimacy and so on, and with de-escalation. If I ever thought that UNIFIL is going to fight Israel's war against Hezbollah, no, it's not going to do that. It's not those people's war.
Thank you. That's a really good explanation, because I think the role of UNIFIL is not always very well understood here. Thank you. You mentioned the Lebanese Armed Forces. The United States government is a financial supporter of the Lebanese Armed Forces. We also provide military equipment. Since it appears that Hezbollah and the left are no longer two entirely separate entities, should the United States re-examine its military assistance to the Lebanese Armed Forces?
I'm a great fan of re-examining, because as we all know, when Passover comes, the most important question is Manishtana. What has changed? What is different today? And policy, like many other tools, is hammered out under some circumstance, and it seems okay. And then the river of life flows on, and then you find yourself in unexpected places and the policy doesn't fit. So I think re-examining the LAF support program is in place. Now, let's say there are two main voices on this issue. One, you could hear in Israel saying, Israel and Hezbollah and the Lebanese armed forces are one and the same. It's no longer separate. You shouldn't discern between them or distinguish, and you should cut it off. It's just a waste of time and money. Another voice is saying, well, it's the only functioning institution in Lebanon. It's a sign of unity. It's useful against ISIS. It fights radical Sunnis. It's okay. Let's keep it going. And if the U.S. wouldn't help, perhaps Iran and Russia will come. And these are all scarecrows. I'm of a middle approach here, because I do think that the LAF is infiltrated, but nothing is in Lebanon is homogeneous. So I don't really expect the LAF to be a place of unity where everybody has the same opinion or the same approach to Hezbollah. So I would go, excuse me, with a differential approach. Designate those who are supporting terror as terror supporters, even if they are LAF officers. And then encourage the more positive elements. Use the aid and support channels to facilitate a constructive dialogue with the Lebanese armed forces, bring them to better practice and performance in interesting places, ask them for compliance on places where they are part of the problem and not helping, like covering up for those who assault UNIFIL and so on. So yes, review with our eyes fully open, both to the infiltration and to the fact that there are people there who are basically okay Lebanese. We can work with them once they're not under the thumb.
Thank you. Moving slightly to the side and looking at Iran, we have a couple of questions that go to the issue of Iran. First, is Iran's financial and military support to Hezbollah curtailed by the current economic crisis in Iran? To go with that, to what degree could Hezbollah be called on to probe Israeli defenses in northern Israel to provide a distraction for Iran from its problems at home? And I'll save the third one. I'll go to it afterwards.
On aid, Iran is under dire straits financially, and money is not as available as it used to. My colleagues from the Washington Institute are, let's say, looking into defaulting payments to fighters, defaulting on jobs, having difficulties to provide all the goodness that Hezbollah is providing the Shiite community. So lack of resources is good news. Does it dry up what they need to keep on providing arms to Hezbollah? No. Do they enjoy very much the fact that many of the logistic transfers going from Iran to Syria, to Lebanon, to Hezbollah, are struck on the way by Israel in the airports or on the ground or ruining the factories? I think they suffer to the point that Nasrallah is saying, yes, Israel is going after anything that is missile in Syria. So yes, I think the pressure works and the bad guys have less funds to finance the military and malign support on the military side from Iran to Hezbollah and other proxies. On diversion, I would say something that would sound strange. Hassan Nasrallah is a national security asset for Israel. You'd ask why? Because this guy went through an experience of like an epiphany. He was very self-confident in 2006. He said, Israel is the cobweb state. It's going to evaporate. It's weak. We're going to wipe the floor with it. And I can predict whatever action I'm doing, I know what Israel is going to do. And guess what? Surprise, surprise. He authorized a kidnapping in 2006. He found themselves, like there was this cartoon saying, I asked you to bring four guys, not the whole Israeli army. So waking up after the war, which was totally destructive for Hezbollah, it took them 7 years to reconstruct afterwards, Hezbollah became very cautious. And Nasrallah personally understood that this risk management and calculation is actually gambling and quite dangerous at that. So Nasrallah, I would think, would be loath to just, you know, tickle the tiger just for distraction. And I'm not sure, by the way, that Iran enjoys a serious distraction. Since the concept of Iran is fighting its wars by other people's hands, from other people's lands, and Hezbollah saw the brunt of war on its back in 2006, ever since it's looking for different frontiers to attack us. Going to Syria, going to Bulgaria, going to overseas and abroad attacks, attacking us from Iraq, attacking us from Yemen, going to the sea. So I think they bend over backwards not to risk the fact that it will go overboard, you know, uncontrolled. At the same time, they recently grew some appetite to show bravado, because the cutting Israel's fence in three places overnight, because Israel struck a vehicle but was very careful not to hit the Hezbollah operatives there, and then publishing an op-ed in Al Akhbar, which is Hezbollah's mouthpiece, is conveying some kind of overconfidence which might prove dangerous down the road.
Thank you. You talked about the stability of the region and Israel's interest in the stability, and also Hezbollah's interest. But can you imagine a situation where Israel would find itself launching a preemptive strike on facilities and capabilities inside of Lebanon?
Yes, I think that should we come to the, I would say two options. One is preemptive when you see that there is an ongoing preparation for surprise attack on you. And if you want to preempt it and get the first strike on your side, that's one possibility. But the probability of Hezbollah initiating a war is not the highest. It's pretty low. The other is more preventive than preemptive, and saying, okay, we're seeing the precision project. We believe that you have now several dozens of precise missiles. We believe that if you go to the next level, which I can't quantify here, but if they get to such a level that they think that they can strike a first blow and cripple Israel's capacity, either infrastructure, economy, or even parts of the military, and we want to be able to stop it before they get there. Now, we have this doctrine pertaining nuclear capabilities. This is what explains Israel's 1981 strike on Iraq's nuclear reactor and 2007 strike on Syria's nuclear reactor, and all the efforts that Israel is doing against Iran so they don't get there. But on conventional weapons, it's more tricky. The red line or the moment when the nuclear reactor is suddenly hot is less vivid. It's more granular and gradual. So yes, I can foresee a situation that if Hezbollah miscalculates and decides to have within a very short period, a very significant arsenal of precise missiles, of accurate missiles, Israel might consider that it's a good idea to try to take them out of the hands of the rival before they use it. So it is a possibility, although not very probable.
Thank you. Given the current security concerns that Israel has on the northern border with Iran, with Hezbollah, what priority level do you think Israelis, not the IDF, but Israeli citizens, assign to the peace process with the Palestinians? What's our kind of priority level for problems with the neighbors?
I'll say, you know, the rarely heard line about the security paradox. My colleagues and I worked, and they still do serve, very hard to make sure that the Palestinian terror threat to Israel is minimized, to the point that the pressure on our governments is minimized and they can take their decisions under minimal pressure, under minimal external constraints. Now, when you turn down the heat on terror, the public goes to its normal life, and the Palestinians are not a problem. How do I know? I'm looking at our elections. It doesn't even appear as an item on anybody's agenda except on the fringe. Like, it's a non-issue. There is a question of what do you do with Gaza? It's not a question of process. Now the next big thing is annexation. Very few, except the professional voices, are talking about it in terms of implications to the peace process, because there's no peace process for a long time now. So I think it's very low on the agenda, which doesn't mean it's not very important. But people deal with a lot of urgent, a lot of attractive, a lot of popular issues, and not necessarily with the important issues. It is important to try to get to some formula of coexistence side by side with the Palestinians, which will ensure Israel's nature as a Jewish and democratic state. That doesn't mean that the public is very interested.
That's a good way to divide up the answer. We have a couple of questions on China. Are you willing to go to China questions?
Sure.
Okay. So the first one has to be, did Secretary of State Pompeo, to the best of your knowledge, come to Israel to ask Israel to curtail its trade with China?
I believe that he came on Prime Minister Netanyahu's invitation. So the reason for the travel can't have been China, because that's not something that Bibi would like to raise and to invite the secretary to discuss. Once he's here, it's surely a very high priority item on the U.S. agenda. And this is because of the priority of the great power competition on the U.S. agenda, on the national security strategy, on the national defense strategy, and so on and so forth. Has he asked to cease trade with China? I don't think so, because the U.S. itself is not ceasing its trade with China. I think it's fair to say that the U.S. is dividing its trade with China to like a traffic light model, things that it doesn't do in red, things that it wants to do more of, like soybeans and pork, excuse my unkosher word, and things that it's still considering. Israel also has a red or a traffic light on China, things that it doesn't do, like military exports and defense exports and even dual use exports. And that's a legacy of the 2000-2005 crises that we had on the Falcon early warning system on the Harpy loitering weapons. So the discussion between the U.S. and Israel for the last year or two, when Bolton was still here and he came to visit, was usually focusing on three things. One is on advanced communication, mainly fifth generation 5G, and not allowing Huawei and Chinese producers to build Israel's 5G infrastructure. Here the story was pretty easy, because unlike many others, and I think including the US, Israel doesn't have a Chinese component in its third and fourth generation cellular, not only in the futuristic 5G. Second was on investment, and here there is an ongoing expectation of better supervision and oversight on Chinese investment in Israel. Last year, end of October, our government decided on building a committee or establishing a committee as an oversight committee on foreign investment. But from my U.S. colleagues, I heard that they think it's too feeble and not strong enough. I believe that some expectations for a stronger oversight were aired in this visit. Specifically, there was a big fuss 2 years ago, starting about what was called the Haifa port. It's actually the Gulf port of the container wharf in Haifa, but there were raised all sorts of concerns of Chinese use of the port for espionage, or using it to take over like they did in Sri Lanka. But the whole model is different, and so on. I don't believe that Haifa is the big thing, but it's a very emotional thing. Like in the Navy, in naval competition between, or maritime competition between the US and China, Haifa port is not a very important thing, but the fact that it's in the home of a close ally is a symbolic issue. So we have a relation issues to manage here. Now the soup de jour now, or the crisis de jour, is another bid or tender for a desalination facility near Palmachin Air Force Base. It's called Sorek 2. Between the competitors is the Chinese company and Hong Kong company called Hutchison, with its subset of Israel Hutchison. And I believe that the U.S. visitor asked Israel to reconsider, and the prime minister said it will be reviewed. Now, how it will end, I'm not sure. So stay tuned. That's not going away anytime soon.
So our last question, because we're coming on to 12:45 our time, then, is an extension of that thought. Desalinization, or China's purchasing of the Tanuva plant in Israel, raises the question of whether you can actually define things as military or not military. Water is a strategic asset, particularly for a country like Israel. So how do you define which are strategic assets that you may not want a country like China to be involved in? And it's really not about tanks and airplanes at all.
No, tanks and airplanes, and even the what I said, the dual use is relics of the past. It's no longer useful. More than that, we should take into account that both U.S. and China have seriously expanded and widened their definition and perception of what's national security. So now, even medical, water, agriculture, AI, anything with AI, big data, quantum computing, everything is national security. So for the sake of, like, Israel needs to protect itself against China in a direct way, against espionage, against industrial espionage, about technology theft, about the aspect of China's relations with Iran, about political leverage through economic means, the whole, let's say, reputational package that China has accumulated globally. And on top of that, we need to be looking in very closely into the eyes of our U.S. ally and look at how China reflects in U.S. eyes. Because although it's not direct, the most severe damage that can be inflicted to Israel because of its China relations will not come from China. It will come from Washington. And not only Washington, it will be a cross-nation issue. And it doesn't even have to be very substantiated factually. It will be enough to have Israel seen by its best friends as standing on the wrong side of history. Now, my best recommendation for ending this is that we need to take our alliance to the next level. We did quite well on the two last decades effort of the U.S. in its war against terror. And Israel proved itself very useful and saved many U.S. lives. And we worked on this shoulder to shoulder, weapon to weapon. The next big thing is the great power competition. Now, the U.S. has been very focused on telling Israel what not to do. That's okay. What we need to do is to ask ourselves, how does our alliance take itself to the next level in accordance to the great power competition? So in this sense, I think we'll be able to invent a strategic innovation and technology alliance and go and develop the great tools that will make our nations both prosperous and safe together. And this is, I think, the mindset that we should approach it.
That is a great positive note on which to end, the strengthening of the alliance and the strengthening of two great democracies. General Asaf Oriom, on behalf of all the listeners and the Jewish Policy Center, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.